I'll go ahead and call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association to order. Roll call, please.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Maria DeAnda.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jason Bordeaux.
Here.
Mike Lynn.
Here.
Jeff Grover. Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Michael O'Neill. Joan Clendenin.
Here.
We have a call.
All right. I think we now have item number three, the rotation of officers.
Pursuant to bylaws, section 1.5, and the rotation by succession of seat number assigned to board members, Gordon Ford is chair of the 2014 Board of Retirement, and Maria DeAnda, 2014 vice chair.
Thank you.
I stand relieved.
Oh, what a relief. Okay.
Relieved and relieved.
Matters under the jurisdiction of the board may be addressed by the general public before or during regular agenda. However, California law prohibits the board from taking action on any matter which is not on the posted agenda unless it is determined as emergency by the board of retirement. Any member of the public wishing to address the board during the public comment period shall be permitted to be heard up to 3 minutes. Please complete a public comment form and give it to the chair of the board. Any person wishing to make a presentation to the board must submit presentation written form, copies furnished to all board members. Presentations are limited to 3 minutes. Announcements. Do we have any announcements?
I have a few.
Go ahead.
The first announcement is that Stan Serra, beginning in 2014, Stan Serra's investment managers will be invited to provide an annual presentation instead of a biannual presentation. And an updated investment manager presentation schedule is included in Stan Serra's executive master calendar for 2014, which is on today's consent item. Another announcement is the updated continuing education record for 2013 is still in progress, and it'll be up for the admin meeting in February for consent. So once that's ready, we'll have that available for everybody. And in addition, Trisha Turner was added to the consent calendar, item 6J, for approval of service retirement, effective January 4th, 2014. Her name was missed in error in agenda production. That's all.
Okay. Public comment. I have one request from Rick Dodge.
My name is Rick Dodge, and back in October during open enrollment, I'm an investigator with the DA's office part-time, 960 hours. I retired November 1st of 2012. And during open enrollment this last year, I saw what was happening, and I came upstairs and asked, is there some way to get reinstated? And I was told no. I later heard that there might be a way, and for me to contact Mr. Santos, and he explained that under section 31680.4 of the government code, there is a way that allows the county to reinstate a retiree. It gives them an option. It has to be reviewed by this board, investigated, and if this board feels it is worthwhile, they would recommend it to the Board of Supervisors. So I'm just officially requesting it be reviewed. It doesn't mandate anybody being hired. If somebody is rehired or reinstated, they start as a new employee on probation, not under the old retirement system I'm currently under, but under a new one. I know this is going to take a length of time, so I'm not really counting on it. They're opening, they have an opening right now, but I just feel that somebody needs to do it, and so I'm officially just asking you to look at it. I only brought six copies. I didn't bring enough. But okay. I brought you 31680.4 and 5. So that's all.
Thank you.
Give it to
our director.
Thank you very much.
And if anybody wants to put this or any other item on the agenda for future, that's at the end of the session when we go to the area of forum. Consent item.
I'll put it back on there.
pull the minutes, approval of the minutes.
You want to pull item A, approval of minutes, anything else? So can I get a motion for the other items to be approved first?
So are you just, Joan, just for clarification, when you say the, you're talking about just 6A, not 6, because there also is approval of special meeting minutes, which is item 6B.
You want to pull B too?
No, I'm just asking which one for clarification are you wanting to pull, just 6A?
No, the minutes of the regular meeting.
Okay.
The special meeting.
All right, so 6A, got it.
Pulling, a request to pull 6A. Any other requests to pull or a motion to approve others other than A?
I'll move to approve.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion to approve B on consent items. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, that passes. Item 6A, you want to discuss?
On 6A, page 3, 8A1, discussion and action to approve for the revised Stan Sarah bylaws. They were the amended Stan Sarah bylaws, not revised.
And if I remember right, you made that clear.
Pardon?
If I remember right, you brought that up when we did this, so you're absolutely right.
And revised appears in the first sentence and the second line of the second sentence.
Okay.
And if it appears anywhere else, I don't think it does, but if it does, it should be changed to amended.
I apologize. That's my fault because I know that you had brought that up and I approve these minutes, so.
Any other discussion on that item? Can I get a motion?
I move the amendments or the minutes subject to Joan's clarification.
Second.
Motion has been moved and seconded. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Okay. Oops. I didn't vote. Mike is now.
Okay, we go on to item 7. Yours, Paul?
Thank you, Gordon. We're going to start with the monthly performance review for the month ending December 31, 2013, which is the halfway point for our fiscal year ending June 30th, 2014. And we'll start with the index performance review. With the Russell 3000 as a proxy for the U.S. equity markets, once again, returning positive performance for December of 2.64%, 1 year of 33.55%. So it was a very strong year for performance, which has lifted the longer-term annualized returns up across the board. Small cap growth was the strongest segment of the U.S. market of 43.3% for the year. It was just a really, really good year for equities in the United States. Non-U.S. December was up 0.9% for the ACWI-X U.S. market. Again, gains, but below the U.S. market, and the one-year number up 15.78%. Bonds yields continued to rise in December. The 10-year ended the year at 3.03%. As yields rose, spreads continued to narrow, though, for U.S. high-yield and investment-grade corporate bonds. And you can see the U.S. high-yield index proxy, the Merrill Lynch Master, up 7.38% for the year. What performed poorly was emerging markets, both equities and bonds. Emerging market equities down 2.27% for the year, and bonds down 6.58%. That's continued into January, and the effect of EM and flows now coming out of EM markets has set a slight correction in developed in U.S. equities the last couple days of a magnitude 3-4% correction. as slowdown in China has become a concern, and there's been a currency weakness in Turkey and Argentina specifically, which has roiled the markets a bit. Page one, this portfolio stood at $1.713 billion at the end of the calendar year. You can see domestic equities has risen with the strength. Fixed income has come down to what the new target policy is actually, and we've been building up direct lending to a magnitude of about 4% by the end of the year. Our current policy will be revised, again, given the allocation to direct lending being built up. And we have a note here where future capital calls to direct lending will definitely be coming from U.S. equities from this point forward, given that non-U.S. equities and fixed income are approximately where their target policy should be. That obviously has helped us having that overweight to U.S. as those markets continue to go up. But it's gotten to a point where it's time to rebalance using capital calls as a method of rebalancing. Page two, an increase of $21 million from the prior month and an increase of $158 million from the prior year. We were at $1.45 billion at the end of 2012. To the $1.713 billion, and that includes the monthly benefit payments that go out, which are, I think, are approximately about $3 million a month. Page three, the breakdown of each of the managers, and page four, our cash levels. The cash levels on page four are quite low for the domestic equity and international equity managers. So there has not been a cash drag on their portfolios that much. Page five, the performance, preliminary performance for December. November also is listed, which we didn't hand out because the meeting in December was early. We did send that electronically, but here you see both months listed on the December 31 performance. For the month of December, equities trailed a bit as Dodge and Cox had their first underperformance month in the 6 months of the fiscal year. Kind of a good November for them all, though. Delaware had a good November, a flat December. Cap Prospects and Legato were both down in November and both up in December. And the asset class itself was 2.36 in December versus 2.64 and 3.5 in November versus 2.9. For the 6 months, once again, all active managers have outperformed, particularly strong Dodge and Cox, Delaware, and Cap Prospects, giving us an 18.84% return versus 17.1. Those are 6 months numbers, and quite spectacular. Fixed income, as we said, the aggregate was down for the month of December, down 57 bips, falling down 37 bips in November. Dodge and Cox, with the heavy overweight in corporates and underweight in treasuries, did well. As we mentioned, yields went up, but spreads narrowed. And you can see the 6 months up 2%, adding 125 basis points. PIMCO, which has a different type of portfolio, heavier in treasuries, underperformed a bit for the 6 months, although Dodge & Cox has four-fifths of the fixed income assets. So overall, the asset class outperformed by 100 basis points for the 6 months.
I have a question.
Yes.
There was a resignation at PIMCO?
Yes, there was.
Is that going to affect us at all?
It shouldn't. But it is, it was interesting that the second in command, Mohammed, to Bill Gross, resigned unexpectedly.
Right.
Yes, our portfolio is not handled by him. It might have an impact on more macroeconomic policy at the top at the committee level.
Which it sounds like it is. growth is starting to move into other areas.
Although, as we know from our visits, it's a very deep resource team, so I don't suspect it will affect our portfolio.
No.
But it's something to watch, John, for sure. And a good point.
Pardon me?
Good point, yes. It was very unexpected. Direct lending, the three managers, you can see, are up to $64 million now. They overall, for the fiscal year to date, up 3.6 versus 4.5. They are down from their benchmark, but it's a J-curve effect used with these private partnerships the first few months. And the fact that they've returned 3.6% for these first 6 months, I'm very pleased with that type of performance. We detailed each of the three managers month by month in spreadsheets with market value, contributions, distributions, and monthly appreciation, depreciation. And overall, as I said, I'm quite pleased with the way the program's going. And at this point, as we get more invested and the quarterly income gets thrown off, we'll be approaching the type of returns of low double-digit net that I would expect to see. Plus, you can see that 3.6 definitely compares favorably to the fixed income managers, and that's kind of an alternative to fixed income for us. International, both managers outperformed for 6 months, December and November, and for the 6 months, up 17 versus 15 in the quarter, with LSV performing quite well. And the REITs with BlackRock and the index, you can see down 4.1% fiscal year to date. We're going to address real estate shortly, which this is included in. Overall, the fund return for December 1.42 versus 1.06, adding 36 bips. November 1.69 versus 111, up 58 bips. I think that continues the pattern every month of positive performance for the first 6 months and excess returns generated every month. And you can see the 6 months up 12.29% versus 10.2. That's over 200 basis points of excess returns. So pleased and obviously hoping we can continue those two positive trends. The rest are the 3 years annualized monthly observation charts. No areas of concern there. In fact, all of them look pretty darn good. I will stop and take any questions on performance.
I assume there's just a timing difference between page 3 and the other pages on totals, like total domestic equity.
Page 3 and what, Gordon?
If you take a look at the total domestic equities on page 3, it's 819 versus 808.
It's because of the cash difference.
Yes, the cash.
I assume it's a timing difference.
It's the cash, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Page 4 would have the balancing item.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yes.
Doesn't seem that long ago we were chasing our first billion.
Yeah, and then and I remember we got to 1.5, and then the crash happened, and we went all the way back down, and it's been a roller coaster, but the last leg has been very nice up.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what do you see in Q1 14? I mean, I know we can't make short-term bets or calls, but
yes.
Kind of, do you think the first quarter is going to set the tone for the next 12 to 18 months? Or?
I don't know if it will. I see, and I can't say it's a Q1 thing, but I see a meaningful correction in public equities happening sometime this year, and it might have started this week. And by a meaningful correction, I mean 10%, yeah. And it'll be, but it just seems that it's almost necessary to have that, to have the next leg up. Small caps are pretty much stretched in the U.S. from a valuation standpoint. But we continue to be in a... I also think yields will be pretty range-bound. It appears whenever yields get to around 3% on the 10-year, there's a ceiling there. And what we're seeing, Rick and I just discussed that. On the long end of the curve, there's a lot of corporate money waiting to be deployed in immunization long-duration strategies. And market investment managers have observed when the yields spike up in the short term to levels where the 10-year is at around 3% and the 30-year in the upper threes, money comes in to help fund these corporations in long-duration strategies or increase their weightings, and that pushes yields back down. And I don't think that's going away. I'd be very surprised. And it appears, though, the economy in the U.S. is better, it's still not strong enough where we'll see yields spike up meaningful. So I think we'll be in this kind of the area we're in yield-wise, which continues to push investors into equities, really. Although, as I said, I think we're overdue for a correction. I would think we would, overall for the year, have equities return mid-single digits. I'd be happy with that, frankly. Which would include that 10%
total return.
Yeah, which would include that 10% correction. And I think bonds will give you around 3%, 3-4%.
Long term?
No, just for the year.
Just for the year.
Just for the year. I think after counting out 4.75 of spectacular equity returns in the US, that's not a bad scenario, actually.
I would take it flat.
Yeah, I think emerging markets on a valuation basis look relatively very cheap, but EM is driven more by flows than valuations.
And the flows go the wrong way.
Yeah, and we've seen what happens with flows. I think,
Do you think that gets reversed quickly, though, with just a little bit of good geopolitical news and economic data out of some of the bigger...
Yes, it will, but it's hard to predict when those flows...
Yeah, but it's going to move quick.
And I wouldn't want to make that prediction. But I would be wary to add to EM despite valuations looking ridiculously cheap almost, just from the flow standpoint.
Yeah, you could get caught pretty bad.
What's that?
I think you could get caught pretty bad on the trade.
Yes, yes.
So what do you do for yield today if it's not traditional bonds and
direct lending? We've already done it.
Would you recommend further asset classes similar to direct lending?
I would not recommend anything else, no. I think the direct lending to me is so attractive for the reasons we went into it. Supply-demand characteristics with the traditional lenders not in the market, or if they're coming back in the market, it's into the middle to the upper area where all our managers concentrate with small businesses or micro-cap type businesses. And I think they will be able to generate those low double-digit net returns by being in the private area, by not having competition, and be having a lot of demand for their supply. Yeah. I think all these other strategies either use financial engineering or leverage to get the type of returns they're getting, whereas our direct lenders aren't using any leverage. And the spreads have narrowed in spread products like mortgages, corporates, high yield, to the point where the opportunity there is not the same as it was in the past couple years.
Is there any correlation in terms of this correction that you speak of that could have some effect on the direct lending asset class? Is the correlation essentially zero?
No, it's not zero, because if the only correlation is if this correction is based, I think the correction I'm talking about is more technical in nature and not based on real changes in macro factors. But if the correction became a correction because of a very pronounced slowdown in the economy, that's what could affect the direct lenders. The companies they're making loans to would be affected by potentially the general economy. But I don't see that happening. I think the market just needs to take a rest.
So then we will get some mitigating effects as we peel off the equity into direct lending as these calls come forward. It'll offer us up a little bit of mitigation to the so-called correction that you speak of.
Potentially. This correction could not it may not happen either.
Well, no, I know. I could be totally wrong if it does happen.
I get totally wrong. But, you know, we saw May, June last year, that type of correction of 8 to 10% when yield spiked up 1%. I think this time it won't be because of yield spiking up. It'll just be because of the market's run so far that technically it needs to correct 5, 10%. And it's using whatever it can as an excuse to do that.
Right.
And the excuse right now is EM inflows.
Right.
What do you think we're going to hear from the president tonight?
I don't pay attention to our president.
Great.
That was a bad question.
There's three things I mute.
It's a little setup. NBC, Barack Obama, and what?
There's one other. I think.
The rest of the media.
Okay.
Want to go into B?
Top 10. Top 10 is, we've talked about the slight correction as of last Friday the 17th. The indices were down about 1% overall. They corrected a little further, as I said, 3 to 4. There's no real thing to note here, except for Apple, the largest cap stock. I had an earnings report yesterday after the close, and the stock was down about $40, $50 today.
Apple,
in reaction to that. That said, that really won't hurt us on a relative basis. Delaware, which used to be way overweight Apple, is either underweight or not in it at all anymore. And we have it in our indexes, obviously, but they're at index weights.
You know what Apple's issue was? I mean, they sold more units of phones than I had, but they didn't make any more money.
As I understand, they met phone units, but I think the market was hoping for more than meeting it. iPads were good, but they, as usual, going forward, their guidance was down. Companies play that game of guidance down in the future so they can easily beat it in the future. But in the meantime, the market didn't like that at all.
They also had a supply issue. They said they could have sold more units had they had their inventory to sell.
It was interesting today, though, that despite the news, the Dow was up 90, and the NASDAQ, which Apple was part of, rallied very strong also. So that was a good sign, at least. I'll take any questions if anyone has on the top.
So we gone on to real estate?
Real estate, yes. I guess we got to the point where we're going to talk about real estate. We've done a review the last year of equities, fixed income, and direct lending. We spend a lot of time selecting and building up the direct lending. It's been as we said, a learning experience for all of us. But we're at the point where all three of the managers have called a good part of their capital, and it's time to move on to the next asset class, which is real estate. And we've have a presentation to go through on that. We already have page 3 looks at our expected returns as of December 2013 versus a year earlier. Real estate has an expected return of 6.2% and a standard deviation or risk level of 18. That is based on REITs only, though, not private real estate. REITs has a long history, and that's what we make our expected returns off of. Page five, we have a current 1.5% allocation to real estate, which is the BlackRock REIT portfolio. Our new policy is 3.5%, so we need to obviously consider adding additional funds to the real estate asset class. Our focus, as we'll explain why, will be on private real estate going forward. And you can see at the bottom our total fund expected returns and risk, including inflation and real returns. Next page, which is the second page, five. Interesting.
We'll call it 5A.
The previous page five should have been page four, I guess. It's an introduction of the private real estate asset class. Real estate's often part of its own asset class, but it can be part of a inflation-hedged real asset portfolio. It's delivered fairly steady returns, except for 2008-2009 crisis period. There is always an issue when cap rates compress, and that's what we're seeing in today's market. Although cap rates are still healthily above treasuries. Next page, we break real estate into private with NCREIF as a property index proxy. And in REITs, we use the BlackRock U.S. Real Estate Securities Index Fund that we're in. We put year-by-year returns of the NCREIF in our BlackRock U.S. REIT Fund. 2013 was for the first 11 months. And you can see large swings in the REIT market. They are real estate investment trusts that pay out 90% of their income or more in the form of dividends. But they tend to be act more like equities than real estate. And then private real estate is a more less volatile due to the way they're priced generally. Cap rates on page seven. This was the end of 2012. They've continued to come down. Core real estate is generally affected by these cap rate compressions, where the expected returns of core real estate are quite low compared to what they've been historically. And that's a function of a lot of flows also. A lot of institutions have moved into or the core real estate asset class since the crisis. We define what a cap rate is here. It's the first year income on a property divided by its current market value. Okay, the next page eight is where we start getting into private real estate. It is three categories generally, going from more conservative, lower risk, lower return. At core, value added in the middle, and opportunistic would be the higher risk, higher return. Core tend to be properties in large, desirable cities that are close to fully leased, and the return is generally an income component with appreciation of land property. Value added tends to be properties that might either be not in the in the primary cities, but the secondary cities, or they could be buildings in primary cities that aren't fully leased. The operator buys them, comes in, has a strategy to increase the lease rate and see value there. Opportunistic is the highest risk, where it could be buying land, for example, developing land, and then either selling it or putting condos or offices on it, that type of thing. Structures are very important when we think about what we want to do going forward. There's closed-end private funds and open-ended funds. Closed-end funds would be similar to private partnerships like we do in direct lending. Open-ended are more like the commingled fund we're with in BlackRock. We could hire a open-end manager with an open-end fund, commit $20 million. They would call the $20 million all up front and put it to work right away. The open-ended fund would also have liquidity by offering investors the opportunity to come out periodically, every quarter generally, or it could be monthly. But at times of stress, they might put a gate on that. We saw that in 2008, 2009. Close-end is like a private partnership, like I said, where you commit $20 million and it would be called over time like a direct lenders. Given what we know, I think we want to seriously consider the open-ended format. Although there might be an opportunity, depending what we do with the REITs, to go into a one closed-end partnership. REITs we already know, and direct property is some funds go out and accumulate their own properties and manage it themselves. We have one direct property in our fund, this four, which we keep on our books. And then portfolio factors, when you're constructing a portfolio in real estate, especially private, is property and geographical diversification. How much in the west, east, north, and south? How much in apartments, office, retail, and industrial, the four major areas? Hotels would be a fifth.
Are any of the investments that you're going to bring before this board, are they or can they be designed to capture a liquidity premium?
Yes, yes, and we'll talk about that. Leverage, there is leverage involved. There's leverage involved in REITs. I mean, all public equities generally have leverage, and REITs definitely do. Core tends to have less leverage than value added, which has less leverage than opportunistic. And liquidity, the reason why I would want to consider private real estate is we are in an attractive position in that we are a fund with meaningful assets. And when we think of ourselves as a fund with assets, we can capture an attractive return by providing those assets as a liquidity provider into more illiquid assets, longer term dated. That to me is attractive, especially when our portfolio is overwhelmingly in public markets today. Direct lending is definitely a step in that direction. But you want to be compensated for that illiquidity, to get that illiquidity premium. And the way to get compensated with those outsized returns is to hire the right manager in the right areas. I think core eliminate. I wouldn't want to be a provider of liquidity in a little illiquid asset in the core arena where you get 6% type of returns. To me, that's not attractive for that lockup. But value added is kind of the sweet spot, whereas opportunistic becomes too risky. I mean, developing land is something we don't want to do either. Page 9, next page, kind of gives you the return profiles. again, I would concentrate in the core plus the value added area. Those are also returns on a net basis that are above our actuary assumed rate. I think that becomes a hurdle rate when you're providing your assets on a illiquid basis to get that premium. But beyond that, it becomes too high risk. Page 10, we list the advantages and concerns of open-ended, closed-end, and REITs. I think for us, open-end funds are an attractive alternative to put our money to work right away and still have a liquidity option there to get our money out either on a income basis or to rebalance at certain times. Closed-end funds, you tend to want to use smaller boutique organizations that have a expertise and skill set where that lockup of your money and capital drawn down over the investment period of a couple years will generate the attractive returns that you demand for that type of setup.
Hey, Paul.
REITs are, one thing we'll have to consider is, do we want to keep our REIT allocation? And if we do want to keep it, at what level? Or do we want to sell that, as Jim mentioned, as a potential possibility a few meetings ago, and put all the assets to work in private type of vehicles? REITs are not cheap now. You can measure REITs based on dividend yields and net asset value discount or premiums today versus historical averages. There's a slight discount today, but they are not cheap. And depending what our goals are, and thinking of this, which we'll explain on a couple pages, but page 11, I'll get to this in a second. This is our BlackRock portfolio at $21.3 million, 1.25%. You can see our target of 3.5% equates to roughly $60 million in the, to build up the full allocation in real estate. And again, in the box at the bottom of page 11 is keeping BlackRock as is, and we would add a roughly $38 million to fund 1 to 2 new private real estate managers. Or the other option is terminate BlackRock and add the whole $60 million to 2 to 3 private real estate managers. Although the more I've thought of this, I probably would think 2 managers out of $60 million total would be sufficient.
Hey, Paul, on page 10, on the concerns with open-ended funds, you put potential delays in exiting. Does that mean, like, if we wanted to sell out, it takes us a longer period of time? Or
if we speak a little more?
On the open-ended funds you list as one of the concerns,
yes,
potential exit way delays. What exactly are you referring to?
Okay.
A lot of people want out at once. They have the ability to open and shut the gate to let people in and out. So like 08, 09, it was a bloodbath. Everybody wanted out of everything. They necessarily raised the cash to get everybody out when they wanted out.
There's, if you want to exit, if you're in one of these closed, in open-end funds and you want to get some or all your money out, you have to notify the manager ahead of time. 30 days, 45 days, six, whatever the amount of days are, or a quarter. If you're at a point in time in the cycle when things aren't going well, and the big example is right in 2008, early 2009 after the crisis, and you want to access your money, and you're in a fund with other...
Put a run on the bank.
And everyone at the same time wants to exit, the manager will put a gate up just to, because they couldn't, if they allow that to happen, they would just get killed selling all their properties at the worst possible time.
And times like in.
And so, but is their call? We have no say.
They have the option of saying no to you, yes. In general, in normal times, whatever normal is these days,
they try to.
It wouldn't be an issue if you wanted to get
this
money out today. But also on the open-end funds, if you want to get in, Conversely, today, where there's so much money trying to get in the asset class, there could be a queue to get into the asset class also. In fact, one of the managers we recommend, JP Morgan, in their value-added fund, they have a 9 to 12 month wait to get in, which is an issue.
But that concern is only for the open-ended funds? It's not a concern?
Yeah, I mean, the closed-end fund is, what's a concern? I mean, closed-end fund, once you give them the money, you can't.
Right.
It's worse on closed-end.
Yeah. There's nothing you can do.
On closed-end, it's like you've got to go find somebody to buy you out.
You know, when it comes, right. Following up on that same question, I mean, and the example of, you know, if everybody runs to get their assets out, obviously the values are going down at the same time because everybody's liquidating. So how does that affect the person that's at the tail end of the liquidation? I mean, I'm assuming that they get less back. Or what about the ones that are in front if they see the run?
It's kind of first come, first serve.
Okay.
So
you get in the queue.
If you're early in the queue, you'll get out before.
And you may not get fully out.
No.
Maybe partially filled.
Right.
Okay. The manager may say, look, we have $50 million request. We're going to take it all the way pro rata across the request.
Okay.
So if you own 3% of the fund and we're going to give you 20% of your money back, you're going to get 20% of your 3% back.
But if things are so bad, they won't give anything to anybody.
So they could just shut it down and hold
sale. It's in their interest to do that until things normalize, when they can start selling some properties at what they deem fair value, raising cash to pay those people trying to get out.
Why don't you talk about how they get paid, their incentive?
They, REITs is just a flat management fee. We're all aware of that. We're in the next fund. It's very low cost. On the closed-end funds, it's like a private partnership. They will get and we show that on page 14. We propose 3 funds, and you'll see management fees. They will get
And the reason I ask is because this may answer some liquidity questions as well,
right.
Why the manager may or may not do it.
You see on the closed-end fund, that's gap 7, the last column, they're just charging a percent on a management fee on committed capital. So you give them $20 million, they'll take 1.5% fee every year. There's no performance. And then there's a preferred return, that's their performance-based fee, where they'll pay themselves, but they won't pay themselves until you, the limited partner, gets a 9% IRR return, and then there's a 80-20 incentive fee thereafter. The open-end funds are J.P. Morgan just takes a percent of the net asset value, 1.25%. There's a debt component that will go up to 1.6. There is no preferred return. An American Strategic Value, the same type of sliding scale management fee with a preferred return over 10%. So it's generally it's kind of set up like a hedge fund or private partnership, where you're getting a base fee management around 1.25% is standard of your assets. And then you're paying a performance fee, but it's above a preferred return IRR benchmark, where they won't take part unless you meet that return, and then there's a split above that.
And just like in the non-traded space, that's what this is it a distribution or a dividend that you receive in your income?
You would have the option of the income. You could have that either distributed to you on a quarterly basis or reinvested in.
Right, but is it a distribution or a dividend?
I don't know, we'll have to ask them.
You mean how it's characterized?
Because sometimes...
We're tax exempt.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
The tax isn't a problem, but if it's a distribution, if it's a 7% distribution, you could be receiving your own money back. It's not a 7% return.
Right.
It's a 7% income stream based on the money you invested versus a dividend, which would be a...
It's not
a return of your capital. It's a return of your portion of the income.
I see.
And most of these guys have a distribution payment method, not a dividend. So we want to know that.
Okay.
Are we getting our own money back, or are we getting real profit and proceeds back?
Right.
On the real estate.
Right. I prefer it would be an income, a distribution of income, I would think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a distribution of our own money.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. And then we'd also want to look at the balance sheet to see how many of them are fully invested and how many of them are sitting on capital.
Right.
Because that's a problem they're all having right now, is deploying capital.
Right. But the nice thing about an open-ended fund is you're buying it into a portfolio that's already been built up. You can see that portfolio.
On an open-ended fund, would they then not pull the capital until they needed it?
They would call it, it all up front immediately.
Open-ended would be called all closed.
Yeah, it would be like a commingled fund. That would be
okay, but the closed.
My $20 million example,
right,
you would get all your paperwork lined up, signed, and okay, starting the next quarter, they would call all your money, and it would be invested in their existing property.
The closed fund is the one that would pull it.
Closed end is like a direct lender.
A little bit at a time as they need it.
Exactly. And that might be something we may not prefer.
You're getting good at it. So.
You're getting better, yeah.
And then do we have product diversification among these three managers you're recommending? So like American Strategic, I'm familiar with American Realty. They typically do like CVS's and Walgreens, and they like to talk, Nicholas likes to talk about buildings at Main and Main in every major town in the country. You know, but they're typically retail, single tenant, high quality tenant,
right,
you know, nice buildings. What's JP Morgan, that portfolio that you're...
JP Morgan is...
Are these malls, are they multifamily, are they...
JP Morgan's one of the bigger funds.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a $3 billion fund. So it'll give you that diversification that you won't get just from an American. It's more national in scope in the primary cities, and it's diversified across geographies and the type of buildings. Greenfield, the closed-end fund, is much more specialized. They would be looking at good properties in the secondary cities that you wouldn't get from a JP Morgan. But they also do sometimes very specialized type of investments. It could be debt-related sometimes, too. And as you said, American Realty is in fewer cities than JP Morgan. But quality type of properties. So it's, I think combined you would get that diversification, and that's why having a big fund operator like JP Morgan would be good to have just from the amount of properties you're getting and diversification.
So I'm the new kid here, I'm new to this whole thing. I'm on the due diligence committee. Are they coming here to talk to us about their product?
They
will. At your discretion. We would not.
There to talk to them?
No. We're going to have them here, right? We're going to have all three of them here.
We would have them here. We would not make an investment in any of these without having them present to the board. As both education / fund offering type of.
I didn't anticipate any other way of doing
it. Yes. I think of the three, as I said, JP Morgan, there's a queue to get in, but that's all right. We don't need to do all three yet up front, I don't think, anyway. If there's a desire, then we would look for a substitute for JP Morgan that doesn't have that queue, but a lot of these big operators, I think that's fairly common today. American, we could get in right away, and Greenfield, we'd have to look at fairly quickly because they're a closed-end fund that is in the market today, but they will be closing sometime in the near future. So kind of getting ahead of myself, but on page 13, we would recommend at the bottom, a initial review and bringing these funds into the board over the next 2 to 3 months. And then decisions can be made whether to move forward or stop.
Have we asked them for a proposal?
Excuse me?
Have we asked these three firms to make a proposal to us, or is that where we're at?
No, we haven't asked them yet. I didn't want to presume that. This is my recommendation on who to look at initially.
What you're saying is, for instance, these would be three we'd talk to, and then we'd make a choice?
Make a choice, or you could say, I don't like any of these, Paul, or I like one of the three, go back and find
us. But you'd want to talk to the three before you make a choice.
Yes. I think you do it on a firm-by-firm basis as they come in and you listen. I mean, whoever comes in first and you like, or you could reserve judgment and hear all three and then make a decision after all three.
The danger, of course, is I like this one, I like this one more, I like that one even more.
Right.
So is your plan to bring them in on separate days?
Whatever you want. You know, a lot of it has to do with the calendar schedule and, frankly, the the bandwidth of one person listening to how many at one time.
How did the board like having all three direct lenders here at the same time on the same day?
The good part
about
it is
a lot of material.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's easier to remember and compare them. Yeah.
My only issue with having them here at separate days is it tends to bias my feelings towards either the first one or the last one sometimes, because I've forgotten the guy who was here a month earlier.
If we're going to get buried in all the material, can we get it early enough to read ahead of time?
That's probably a good idea.
Paul, we're aware of these three.
When we do this,
you're open to more than just these three managers.
Of course. Oh, yeah.
So, Paul, is there some criteria that you use to narrow it down to these three? Or did you just pick one of each type?
No, there's a, we did a little.
We did, and we decided to bring it with the next.
Okay.
With when we were going to give it to the board, Paul did a synopsis of what their process was. So we'll make sure you get that so you know what SIS's right. process was in finding and researching these managers.
Okay. Let me. So our firm has never, I'll say this a cat, we've never said we are experts in the real estate area. That said, we have begun to do this type of work for some of our funds that don't have specialized real estate consultants. We have a lot of large public plans that has 5-10% of their portfolio of real estate, and they have separate real estate consultants like a Townsend or a Cortland or whatever. Combination of doing work for other funds in this area in real estate and me being an observer with a couple of my other funds who have real estate consultants. That's kind of how I brought these three funds. What I did for the open-end funds is I centered on the value-added space. I didn't look at core and I didn't look at opportunistic. Most of the open-ended funds are, frankly, large firms in the core space. But because there's so much money going into core and cap rates compressing and the expected returns being 6-7% for illiquidity and opportunistic being too risky, I centered on value-added. I started with the top 100 commingled real estate funds list, of which there were less than a handful of value-added funds, and I looked at those. I list those on page 13. Clarion, J.P. Morgan were the two. We have experience with J.P. Morgan, and we listed on page 14 and 15 returns and their comparisons. I've also met through the real estate consultants with other clients, American Realty, who has a smaller boutique shop. Although they have a large core fund, they also have a value-added open-ended fund. And I've done an on-site at their office, so I met the team running that money. Again, this is very different than a public market search where you have a list of every product and you can go through all the criteria and your hurdles. It's more direct lending is knowing the market and meeting them. So from that, we came up with J.P. Morgan and American Realty. For the closed-end funds, I frankly, based on my work with San Joaquin and University of Missouri, who both at Cortland as a consultant, this is a manager that's been recommended to both of these funds. San Joaquin is now investing in their second fund with Greenfield. And I, my opinion, they're the best value-added manager that either of these two funds has, and that's why I'm recommending them. Again,
Paul, when we first got into the private equity, there was a concern that the banks, because of regulations, some other things, there was a window of opportunity. On real estate, do you feel there's also a certain window of opportunity, or is this one that we can take more time?
No, not really.
You know,
it's more of a longer-term strategic.
So this one, we could take more time interviewing several of them or deciding how we
You could take more time, but Greenfield is closing soon. The open-ended funds, you can take more time, no question.
Okay.
Greenfield, but if you want to take more time, there are other funds out there besides Greenfield, too.
Okay, so then the question is, in proceeding, would it make sense if Greenfield is the opportunity to look at them first?
If you don't want to invite all three in.
I thought we were going to do all three.
Well again.
Maybe.
It depends. If you want to scale them in here.
Maybe this would be a good reason to get Greenfield in first. The
I think
first
Greenfield
one,
first.
Get our toes wet, make us feel comfortable
yes.
with the idea. Would you like to do that? And then that'll all solve the problem that they're going to be closing the fund pretty soon. And we don't have to do anything with them. We don't want to.
Now, do
and
they
I guarantee
close
you, as
the
soon
fund?
As they close fund two, fund three is already packaged and ready to go.
That's what I was going to ask.
There'll be some time because they won't come out. This is fund seven, actually.
Yeah, I mean,
but there's an investment period, generally a 1 year after they close. Mm-hmm. So they won't come out with fund eight until they approach the end of the investment period.
Okay, but they can tell us that too.
Yeah, they'll tell. But Gordon, you're right. They're not the only value-added closed fund in the world.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out where to start.
Right. But that you're right. That would be the place to start because of a timing issue with them.
Okay. And my only point is, Jason had the point earlier. What about the fourth and the fifth and the sixth firm? Will we consider them too? And apparently, we won't.
It's we could bring you more. It depends what your appetite is. We can obviously bring more funds in for you to review. I would suggest that look at these three first, and if you have issues with any of the three or all of them, we can continue to bring more to your, bring more up front. If you like, I could add three more to this list. I can add another open-ended value-added fund and another closing. I can bring two more, one more open-ended.
But my own point, Paul, you said earlier that you're not a real estate expert. Should we hire a real estate expert?
It's expensive.
It's $60 million that we're talking about.
Well, I don't know. How much?
I think, it's up to you. I believe we can together do the job. You would be paying a fee similar to what you're paying me most likely on 5% of the...
Why don't we take a look first, at least look at one of them and see what our comfort level is. Are we understanding what they're saying? Do we get a real sense of opportunity?
Is there a certain dollar value you have to put up to be part of them, or is it like a stock, you can buy any number of shares or whatever.
I mean, with each of these three?
Yeah, in other words, if you're talking to somebody, you're talking $10 million, $20 million, or it's kind of up to you.
I think I'm not sure what their minimums is. I know deploying 60 million amongst the three of them, they don't have to be equal weighted. We would meet each of the minimums there. I suspect Greenfield probably has a $5, $10 million minimum, and the open-ended funds are probably $5
million. Okay.
So we would definitely, that's not an issue.
Okay.
Would it help if we knew before we brought anybody in here to know how we're going to allocate this $60 million across this asset class? Because I don't want to waste time and bring somebody in here and then it ends up not fitting in with our the way we allocate the assets off that around that class when we bring the third, fourth, and fifth person in.
Yeah, I think one decision is, do we want to keep our REIT allocation?
Right.
If we know the answer to that, then...
Okay. Can I make a suggestion? I'd like to spend now, I guess that I have to confess that I overlooked a little bit the importance of this decision right now, and I would like to spend at least a few weeks deciding on what, how we want to allocate those assets across the space before we start bringing people in here.
Okay.
I think we're going to be spinning our wheels if we bring this person in, and the next person in, and then we just say, well, we don't want to allocate our assets that way. We want to do it a different way. And we can have this done as soon as next month. We can have this discussion, and we can come back next month and talk to you guys and figure out what's the best way to allocate the assets across that space, given our investment needs.
And the second meeting next month?
Next month, yes. I feel that this is starting to get out of hand if we're going to be talking about bringing in 5, 6, 8 investment managers in here, and it's going to be 6 to 8 months before we finish this thing off, and I don't know if I want to do that.
Well, the question is, too, is this an opportunistic type of investment? Because I feel us also going back to, we're going to overanalyze some things, and we end up either not going in a direction that we should have, and we end up regretting it, or we buy in at a higher price time and regret that too. So that's some of the types of concerns that I have. Because typically we don't necessarily interview 5 to 6 different companies when we're going to invest in a particular money manager. We bring in 3, generally speaking. And we, and you, I think, have recommended that we pick at least 2 would be the ideal.
2 to 3. It depends, Maria, whether we have our REIT allocation or not.
You're talking about the one we're currently in?
If we get rid of our REIT allocation, we're deploying the 6.
So we have to compare what we're in versus whether we want to put
it
somewhere
fit?
Else.
Right.
Okay.
Maria, my only comment to that would be, you typically bring in 2 or 3 large cap value or large cap growth managers, right? They're all kind of doing the same thing. This is a different business altogether. I mean, you have REIT managers that are focused and specialized just in mini storages. Mm-hmm. You have them in healthcare, you have them in server farms, you have them in warehouse and industrial, you have them in multifamily, you have them in apartment buildings, commercial buildings like the Raleigh Shopping Center, you have the mall managers, you have real estate managers. It's just as different in style as having an emerging markets and an international and a large value, a large growth, and a small and a mid, in all of those different categories.
Right.
So there's no one solution where we can say, here's a manager of funds that we get kind of all those industries and all those assets across the globe. I'm not into the details at all. And the last thing I want to do is talk to managers ever. But in this case, I think that, you know, the REIT business is one that in the early part of the 2000s was really good, and then 08 and 09 came along and we got to see when the tide went out, using Warren Buffett's famous phrase, we got to see who was skinny dipping when the wave went out. And the REIT business got hit really, really hard, and I think we owe it to the fund to do a really good job of due diligence and figuring out the type of manager we're after,
right,
and the product mix first.
Exactly.
So it's not like we're just looking at large value.
This is a different issue than we faced with the direct lenders, because the direct lenders didn't really necessarily have a market niche. They all kind of did the same thing,
yep.
And we didn't have to worry about this. This is, as he eloquently put it, the issue here is, as kind of I mentioned earlier, we got to figure out what we want to do with our money first and then bring those that satisfy that criteria.
Well, but I agree, I don't necessarily want to wait those 8 months either.
Well, no, but I almost have a...
I want to birth that baby.
I agree.
But
it scares me, though, if we just continue to bring in managers here, that's what we're going to do.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I agree that if we can do it by next month is, you know, sit down and say, okay, based on this information, and I agree with Gordon in terms of if we can get information in advance to try to determine, okay, what kind of real estate do we want to get to?
Right.
You know, and let's help the world and not build more strip malls. That's just into the editorial. But anyways.
Just at the time everyone goes online and we don't have anything.
Yeah, so that by the next meeting that we have, like, all of us would be more educated so that we can move.
I think so.
We've already decided we want to go into real estate. That was step one. Next, our next step is, part of it is, what are we going to do with our REITs? Do we want to stay there? Do we want to get out? And... do we want to go into which real estate investment field, if you will?
Farmland.
Oh. That goes on with timber. But anyways.
That's a whole other rest.
That's a whole other. But anyway, so what I do want to say is I don't want to regurgitate this over and over again, and we don't make a move. We're stymied by our own.
Yep. Over or micro or just our own.
Have we stopped your presentation? Do we need to go back to it?
No, I think we're...
So well, is there anything else you could tell us that might help us ponder this for our next discussion?
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what my thinking is. I think I would recommend getting rid of the REIT allocation. I would do it for two reasons. One, they behave more like equities than real estate. Two, we've seen how they perform when rates go up. And it's an ugly performance type of situation. Three, our real estate allocation is just 3.5%. And based and agreeing with the theme that Rick has presented, having that in longer dated type of assets is not a bad thing given what our liabilities are.
So I don't misunderstand you. You're not saying get out of it now.
No.
You're talking about converted to something else.
Use it to help fund private real estate managers. Two, as regards to the $60 million now, as I see it going into private real estate, first decision generally is where are you comfortable on the return risk or risk return spectrum? And for what I've laid out already, I'm the comfortable in the core plus value added space where you're getting away from the core space, which is a crowded trade and a low return type of environment today due to flows coming in and various factors, away from the highest risk area of opportunistic and into that more center space of value added core plus of 9, 10, 11% type of returns net potentially, which is above our actuary assumed rate and is a return I'm comfortable for having a lockup of my assets liquidity. Based on that, I like having a half to all of the assets in open-ended type of vehicle where all your capital is called up front, you know what the properties are in that pool already, and it's ease from an administration standpoint. Potentially a third of those assets could be in a closed vehicle that is more specialized boutique. And then the goal would be, as Jason said, it was to bring in initially three managers who are somewhat different, who would complement one another, who could achieve those returns each independently, but there's some correlation benefits between the three. That's
the way I see it up here right now.
No, and the liquidity you're getting out facet, you said open-ended easier than closed.
Yeah, the liquidity on an open-ended, you should have the ability to withdraw funds on a quarterly basis unless there's times of stress. On the closed-end vehicle, it's like a direct lending partnership where capital is called and you get it back in distributions in the future, but you have no option of getting it back without selling it on the secondary market at a steep discount often.
But again, since we are kind of looking at this long term, and I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, since Rick has come on, so I do this, is we're looking at longer term liabilities. We're looking, you know, 20, 30 years down the road as our retirement payments come due to be able to pay for those. And just like this recent cycle that we've seen, you know, we had this crash 5 years ago, and now we're coming out of that.
Yes.
So I'm almost going to say worst case scenario, if we were to have something like that again, is it something we could wait out?
Yes, it is. So, although it would be very, it would be potentially very uncomfortable in that short term period. not any less uncomfortable than the public market.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we can avoid that uncomfortableness with any of our assets in that type of environment.
Right.
I like the idea of having the manager as a co-investor. And that only happens for the closed-ended funds. Now, I like that idea because if we go down, he's going down too. You know, it seems to me that makes everyone more attentive.
And if we don't have the necessity of having to draw money out, at least not in the short term, I agree, I tend to go in that direction myself.
I mean, it's...
That's like a big selling point for me. And, and so if that doesn't offset the other disadvantages, you haven't explained it well enough to me, or I don't understand it yet.
I want to stress... Whatever we decide and whoever we bring in front of you, if any one of you is uncomfortable with anyone, let's not move forward. We took our time on direct lending, and we, I think, did it the right way. And this is as Maria said, this is not an opportunistic, we have to get in right now type of thing. This is a long-term strategic allocation that we can not be compelled to make a decision right away if we don't have to, and just do it the right way where we're all comfortable.
Okay, and I think also since this is not a discussion and action item, and I get a strong feeling that there are some questions that we need to have you weigh in on, that we do need to come back next month and ask these specific questions before we bring anybody here. I think we're too soon to bring anybody in front of you right now.
Do you think you have enough direction to go from?
I think I know exactly the questions that we need to decide, but I need to figure out in my mind how I need to formulate that and understand that myself before I can ask you.
Okay. Paul, anything you need from us as far as direction?
No, I think we'll come back to you next month with a more blueprint plan. And then we'll have you act on that. And if amenable and agreed, we will start the process of bringing some managers in. But I understand part of this, you're relying on my experience to bring the right type of groups in front of you. And I'm sorry to say, it's just not as clear cut as in the public markets where you're searching for a large cap growth manager with a 5-year track record with a team and excess and assets on it. It is a different type of animal in the private world, as we know from the direct lending. And I am definitely open to being questioned on what I'm doing and bringing forth, but my intentions are definitely honorable, and I think I'm very close with some people at Cortland due to our relations with other managers, and what I am recommending would be similar to what they would recommend.
I'm also hoping that you'll protect us from the real bad situations out there.
Yes.
That's more critical to me.
Me too. Let's just say the meetings are a lot more pleasurable today than 4 or 5 years ago. So.
Yeah.
You've got skin in this game.
Yes.
Yeah.
When PERS got into trouble with real estate investments, were they different than what you're talking
yes.
about? I mean, were they just...
They were managing.
My impression was that they went out and invested in a building that was being built.
They were isolated investments. And
they were
isolated investments that went south.
Individual.
Yes.
Frankly, right. This money was the beneficiary of a lot of those bad PERS and STRS deals, because these were the managers that provided liquidity for those really, really big pension funds. They had $100 million into a building and they were taking 40, 45 cents on the dollar. And these were because banks weren't lending, remember, this was the only liquidity vehicle
these guys
that was available. So that's the opportunistic side of it. Oftentimes they're looking at a seller that has something that's a dog with fleas in their mind, but it's gold to somebody else and they're providing the money for it.
Wow.
It was more of a staff, it would be like Rick, Kathy, and Louie buying buildings on behalf of you and then managing those buildings.
Hey, you're
then,
good. Trust you.
And then
strict investment policy statements.
And being
and buying them from Joan.
And being forced to buy a certain percent of buildings in this county.
Yeah.
And then the equity markets tank, but the real estate holdings too much of a pool, part of the pool. And they're going to liquidate the top.
Right.
Yeah.
To rebalance investment policy.
And that's what PERS stands for.
So this matter is going to be continued to next month?
Yes.
Is that?
Anything else we want to do with this item?
What's that, Gordon?
Anything else on this item?
We'll no, we're done.
You're done then, and we move on to Rick.
Thank you.
And we're going on to...
8A.
Yeah, actually, that's...
So to Kathy. Okay.
Kathy, you can talk.
Okay, I will do that, Joan. We are coming back to the board to talk about extending the contract with the Chiron EFI Actuaries. In 2008, we conducted a RFP process for the actuarial services and the auditing actuary. At the time, EFI, which is now Chiron EFI, was hired for the five-year contract, and then we hired Milliman to do the audits. Last year, the board agreed to extend the Chiron EFI contract for one more year, and which would allow us time to do the request for proposal. And in preparing for that, we went looking for the actuarial vendors, and we found that in a pretty small pool of people out there doing this work, surveyed the 37X systems. Most are either using the Chiron EFI group or the Siegel group. A couple others are using a few others. We also found in my research in surveying and talking to the different 37X systems and comparing their annual reports, the fees that we are being charged are very much within reason across the board for our size of a fund and for the amount of work that, in addition with the special studies and stuff that have had to be done because of PEPRA and stuff. The other small problem in the vendor pool is Milliman, because of their insurance issues, is not available to us to even propose, to send us a proposal. And the audit that was recently done by Siegel confirmed that Chiron's assumptions are reasonable. You will be making a decision on some recommendations, but overall, Siegel Group agrees with the Chiron valuations. In addition, Chiron has been contracted as the actuarial expert for a couple of litigation issues. So they are being used for those as well. So at this time, we are asking the board to extend the Chiron contract for the remaining two-year option. That will give us time to work through possibly some litigation issues, to concentrate on the custodian bank transition and any other major RFPs we need to do this next year.
Any comments or motion?
Well, and this is an $8,000 retainer plus an hourly rate?
Right.
with the cost estimate compared to what's on here?
Yes, I did.
Annualized.
Yes, they are quite reasonable.
Can you elaborate on the third bullet?
The document that administrative expenses of the system being funded entirely
I can
by the
do
employer?
That. Can I
yes,
take
I,
this
I was
one?
Just making sure I knew which bullet you were talking about. Go ahead. We'll let you talk to that one.
Yeah. Last year, I don't know if you remember when Graham presented the actuarial evaluation, there's a GASB recommendation, a new GASB recommendation, that instead of building the administrative expenses into the discount rate or netting out the admin expenses from the discount rate, that you don't touch the discount rate, you leave it at what it is, and you put a line item in the employer rate that says the employer pays this, plus the administrative expenses, which represents what we have to pay to, you know, run the ship. So what run the organization?
$1 million at this.
Yes, exactly. And so the actuary converts that to a percent of payroll and just adds that to the employer rate. What that did, though, last year is that implicitly means that the employer is picking up all the admin expense costs, because before it was built into the discount rate, which goes into calculating the employer and the employee cost. So now when you take that netting out of the discount rate and you put it just under the employer rate, that implies that the employer is paying the entire admin expense and the employee is not bearing any of that. Last year when Andy Young from Siegel was in here, he explained that, yes, that's okay, there's nothing wrong with that, but he suggested that we document that in the actuarial evaluation, and that's what this is.
Okay.
And by the way, this issue was discussed with the county prior to us actually putting that in there, so they knew. Stan and I had a nice conversation about this. They knew that this meant that the employer was taking on that full cost, and so. But this just kind of covers.
What are we talking about in terms of dollars? We're talking about the $1.2 million.
It's about $2 million actually across the entire system. Probably 1.8 of that.
We're adding $2 million to the county's contribution to the fund.
So what we would do is if we spend $2 million here administratively, we would divide by the payroll to come up with the rate as a percent of pay, and we would tack that on to the employer contribution. And we did that explicitly last year for the first time.
I assume the documentation is not extensive.
Yeah, it's probably a paragraph.
Okay.
That'll be in the actual evaluation.
Okay.
It's not a big deal.
Any other questions?
And basically, it's a done deal.
Yeah.
I mean, if the county ever came back and said we don't want to do that, or, you know, we think the employees should pay their share of the admin expenses, we could always go back, and we couldn't put it back in the discount rate, but we'd have to figure out some way to allocate it across the employer and the employee cost.
And there's no law on this one yet.
They don't want you to incorporate it into the discount rate. I'm sure we could defy them if we wanted to, and nobody would do anything to us.
Don't want to get in legal trouble.
No. It is more transparent because it does show you exactly what the admin costs are as a percent of the payroll.
Okay.
So the question here, what we're asking here, is that this board authorize the RIC to enter into and sign the amended agreement to extend the Chiron EFI contract through January 31st, 2016, which is the end of the original three-year option.
Can I get a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. We go on to B.
Okay, SEC lending collateral pool. After we sign the agreement for Custodial Services Northern Trust, we're going to have to, as part of the pricing structure that they agreed to in the RFP, included a SEC lending collateral pool. And just to refresh your memory, securities lending, the concept behind securities lending is that Stan Sarah has a portfolio of securities, our equities, our bonds, and there are people out there in the world who want to borrow those securities from us and sell them in the market, cover some positions that they may have open with those. And what they do is they borrow them from Stan Sarah, they put up collateral either in the form of cash or in the form of securities, And then at some point in time, they've got to give us back those securities, and we essentially give them back the collateral. And in the meantime, we make a small rate of return on the collateral that's put up on their behalf. So what we have to do is, before we enter into the contract with Northern Trust, we have to decide a cash collateral pool and a non-cash collateral pool. The cash collateral pool is what we would accept from the borrower. The non-cash collateral pool is what we would accept from the borrower as a form of collateral. That's pretty much a given. Northern Trust really only has one pool there, and that's just government securities, agency securities, government securities. So there's really no question there. The question is, what do we want Northern Trust to do with cash that's put up as collateral? If the borrower puts up cash, then what do we want Northern Trust to purchase as collateral with that cash that they put up? There's two choices, and the choices are not that much different. And before I explain them very quickly, I want to tell you that what I'm recommending in this agenda item is the least risky out of the two. That's just plain and simple as that. And another thing is that there's no less risky alternative on the table here. So what I'm recommending is the absolute least risky collateral pool that we can actually go into. And having said that, do you even want me to explain the differences between the two pools that we can choose from for the cash collateral? Or is it just good enough that you understand that the pool that I'm recommending is the least risky?
Let me ask Paul, what do you think? Is it reasonable?
Paul, I agree with Rick.
Could we make more money on the other option?
Can I answer that?
Yes, you can make more money, but you could lose more money.
Let me answer that. As stated in the agenda item, I don't think the purpose of a securities lending program is to enhance the returns on your portfolio. We get 95% of our returns on our portfolio based on our asset allocation. I think we need to look at the SEC lending program as a way to offset some of our custodial fees.
I move the staff recommendation.
Second.
My question is, who's watching this?
Northern Trust.
So they're doing the investing and they're doing the monitoring.
But we're telling them how to invest.
Yeah. Yes.
We're telling them what they can. That's what this whole item is about.
Limit yourself.
They already have the money.
Right. Yeah. And this is part of the pricing structure that we got. Inherent in the pricing structure that we got from Northern Trust was an agreement to lend out some of our securities and do this program.
What the treasurer does when?
Let me ask Paul again. Is given the potential returns in this interest rate environment, is security lending worthwhile? Given today's environment, is security lending worthwhile?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Northern Trust and everyone else has done a 180-degree turn where they are probably ultra-conservative in how they manage the cash collateral, which is a good thing. Because
call the question.
I don't, and no one else wants to go through what we went through.
So are we looking at a return of more than 0.01?
Probably. A little bit. I don't know. A little bit. Yeah, because that's... Well, no, it's probably really close to that because it's just short-term investments that are generally less than 365 days.
Not a whole lot.
So we will get, though, if they do invest in longer duration government securities, we will get more than that for the period of time that we're invested in this because they're yielding 3%.
It's a point in time, maybe 5 years from now, where rates are up higher and we'll make more.
Yeah, exactly. I think the answer to your question is we will more than likely get more than that.
Than the 0.01.
Yes.
But it helps the...
That's what I'm getting downstairs.
So you're losing money.
No, I know. That's why I'm moving with this.
Okay, any other thing? We call for the question here. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Passes.
Where are we?
I think that we should bring members' forum up because we're going to have, when we go into closed session, we're going to do one item and then Joan and Michael have to leave.
Okay, we want to move on to members' forum first, take it out of order, and then come back to 9, which is closed session. So, members' forum.
They don't have to leave on that?
Nobody has to leave.
There's no. Okay.
No closed session.
No, there is a closed session.
Okay, so, okay.
Might as well stay for it.
All right, so we can go into closed session, never mind.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'll take a motion for closed session.
Okay, I move to go to closed session.
Okay. Move in second, all in favor, signify saying aye.
Aye.
You were the first.
Nothing to report from closed session.
Actually.
On 9B, but there is on 9A.
Yeah, for the closed session for 9A, motion was made by Darren Garrett and seconded by Donna Riley to accept executive director's 2014 goals. And as far as 9B, there is nothing to report.
Okay. Moving item number 10, that's for comments for future meetings, and I'd like to include, we didn't have a meeting in January because people went to a meeting.
Opal's.
So feel free if you want to say something about Opal. We didn't get any feedback on that.
Also, before we go around the table, this might be a place to ask any preliminary questions on Mr. Dodge's plea earlier today in public comment.
If anybody wants to bring that up.
I would like to bring it back and see it agendized. I just for the sake of, you know, we've never had this request made before formally. You know, we've had general inquiries in the past from retired members, but nothing formal to this level. And I think it would be beneficial just so the county can enter into a dialogue with their county departments and see if there's an appetite with the county CEO staff and the Board of Supervisors if they want to authorize the acceptance of 31680 of the government code. And that's really where the dialogue needs to start.
Can I say something? I instead of, however, maybe we're going about this the wrong way, I think I would really like to get a feel for what the county wants to do first. He never really approached the county. I've been talking with Nancy Bronstein, and Nancy's original thought was, well, I don't know if anybody here wants to do anything like this. So I guess what I'm saying is, before I go and spend a lot of time on, you know, analyzing this, what the costs are going to be, because there's going to be costs. There's going to be costs to implement this. This is a benefit.
Well, now, wait a minute. We're just going to put it on the agenda for next time if we want to do this.
Yeah,
give you time to talk to them if you want.
Okay, but what type of, do you want me to really dig deep into this? And
no, I think
we need to talk about it rather than making that decision.
My reason is just, you know, see what the appetite is with the CEO staff and the Board of Supervisors. If they really feel that this is something that is of beneficial to them, if they come back at the next meeting and say, you know, we've roundtabled this, we've looked at it, we've entered into a dialogue with our county department heads and whatnot, and we don't feel that we want to move forward at this point, we're done.
Okay.
So I'm not asking for okay. a recreation of the Great Wall here. I'm just saying that allow people the opportunity
okay.
to look at it.
Yeah, we should be able to tell Mr. Dodge, right? That was
Dodge.
The county's not interested.
So if I go,
if they are, then we do the work.
Okay.
The analysis.
So if I go back and I talk with the county and get more information from them, and they really don't want to go down this path, is it okay for me to come back to you and say county doesn't want to do this?
Yeah, I'd say put on the agenda. And give us feedback either way.
I would like to, on the agenda, tell the county it's agendized the next meeting whenever it's appropriate, and to have them here. They're usually here. And they can then comment and say, you know, we've done our dialogue or whatever with our county departments and roundtabled it with our staff, and we've decided we don't want to go forward at this point. Done.
So you want an agenda.
I want to ask a question about this particular. Do we know more about this than he said today?
What do you mean when you say? I mean, I know some preliminary facts.
That's what we find out on the agenda.
All right, he's working half year now, right?
Retired annuitant,
right.
You know, Joe, my concern is that we're getting far afield.
Yeah, we don't want to
comment.
Talk about it.
I think this is what you're going to ask and what the
right.
discussion is, what should take place when we agenda.
Right, and I think I've gotten out of this what I wanted to get out. You tell me what I should do with this.
Yeah, it's fine.
And I think I've gotten that.
Okay. All right, put it on the agenda.
Let's go around then, Maria.
I have nothing.
I actually wanted to ask him a question,
okay.
But I didn't know if I could.
No, not appropriate at this time.
Okay.
But it will be appropriate next time.
Okay.
Anything else?
No.
I went to the Opal conference as well as a number of others, and it was an eye-opening experience for me as somebody new to the board.
And an exhausting one.
It was good. I mean, you know, it was good for me to go and experience something different, because I go to investment conferences, and that's not what this was. This was, you know, I think the last session was almost like the Union Hall. It's like grab the pitchforks and burn everybody.
Kind of a culture shock.
Yeah, it was a culture shock. That's a good way to put it. So anyway, I did learn a number of things, and excited about it.
Anything we should follow up on? Because sometimes there are items that people say we should talk about an investment in X.
Or education.
Or anything else.
I think education is a big component that we should be focused on, and I don't know that that conference lends itself to a great deal of educational opportunities.
Okay. Jim?
I just want to make a comment about the high number of complaints about the insurance. That was the highest amount of complaints I can ever remember reading. Looks like there's a lot of unhappiness there. I just wonder if the county should take that over.
Well, they have taken over part of it, and that's part of the problem, is that there's this transitional period, and things aren't going very smoothly after the county. Maybe you can comment a little more, Michael. You might.
No, there was kind of a disconnect because some things happened at the last minute. The county wanted to take over pre-Medicare folks. Right. We didn't get information out timely. Some of the retirees' information didn't get out timely because we were waiting for information to mesh, and it never happened that way. And our consultant, I guess you could call him, wasn't really diligent enough as part of the process getting, dotting all the I's and making sure the math was correct, basically, making sure the math was correct on what people needed to have taken out of their check. And Stan Sarah can only take out what's said. They sign and says, take this out. And so there was a lot of confusion. I have to compliment Stan Sarah's staff. They worked into the night.
Yes, they did.
As well as our consultant did, trying to resolve these issues. We've since had a meeting with our consultant and explained that it's not acceptable. And not answering the phone is not acceptable. Putting the phone on hold when you have chaos is not acceptable. You need to bring in warm bodies and talk to people. So we hope that that issue has been resolved. But if the county wants to take it over.
So we went to a lot of trouble.
Is there anything this board should do about situation, or is it?
No, just I want to be sure everybody reads it.
Well, I think the confusion is that, you know, the county has taken over the medical portion of the pre-Medicare retirees only. Dental and vision is still with RESCO for all the retirees.
And dental or just vision?
Dental and vision, mm-hmm. Both. And you know, RESCO is retaining through their health insurance consultant the Medicare group. So I don't think the county is going to take on the Medicare group per se. But you know, maybe to Jim's point, you know, have a dialogue with them taking over the dental and vision, which I think when looking at these complaints would probably eliminate half of them that you saw here today. I think that's where the dynamic is with all of this. So I think Jim's got a valid point.
Who is your consultant?
Patrick McTighe.
Okay, because I remember the last time I heard anything, RESCO was having a problem with the company
and he's separated from the company. And we maintained him as our consultant because we had discussions with the company and we just weren't comfortable with him. I mean, we have a 20, Stan Sarah and the county and RESCO has a 25-year relationship with this individual. And these other guys who were running the company, they were from Bakersfield and Sacramento. And we just didn't feel comfortable with him. So,
yes.
And
as much as we can, the problem
RESCO's
is
credit. RESCO has half-time paid staff.
We should jump in.
The rest of the stuff is other than done by non-unpaid board members and volunteers. So So, but we do it because we feel there's a service needed for retirees.
So, Michael, you can go back to Resco now and tell them that there's a, there's an advocate for, yeah?
I think it really means, Mike, that we have the county's responsibility, at least up to, you know, retirement age of 65.
And the dental and vision, I think, is easy.
There's a certain level of service I think they should get, but I'm not criticizing Resco, but I bet they really do. I don't know, I just hate to see this.
I know you all know, but I just want to iterate, these complaints aren't against Stan Serra. We're just, we're the brunt of these calls.
I said maybe something might change here if this continues.
Don, anything?
Nothing from me.
I have nothing else to add, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mike?
I enjoyed the OPAL conference, and I appreciated the opportunity to sit down with the Northern Light people for dinner and talk to them in some depth.
That was good.
Yeah.
Who's it? I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Northern Trust.
Northern Trust.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think the picture of Mike at the top of Mount Camelback ought to be in your next newsletter.
That is a wonderful idea.
That was not one of those self photos.
Selfie?
I was accused of faking that.
Hey, listen.
Jeff Grover.
The helicopter noise was...
I'm going to do it in my voice.
Staff, anything we have?
I have nothing.
Okay. Call adjournment.